Thank you very much. Welcome, and I do apologize for not being here last week, although I understand I had quite an excellent substitute. It reminded me a little bit that when the Vilna Gaon was in Vilna, so the Vilna Gaon started a lot of classes for Balabatim. People think the Vilna Gaon was, of course, the greatest of the Talmidei Chachamim, and he would only darshan to the greatest scholars, which was normally the case. But he wanted to establish a lot of shiurim for the common folk, Chayei Adam and Yaakov, we discussed in our last shiur. But what is interesting is, he not only arranged for there to be teachers, but he actually gave the first class to kind of inaugurate it. So imagine, you were a working person, you show up after Mincha, and the Vilna Gaon is giving you one shiur. Now, I don't mean to say that, you know, you are the common folk, that's not the case, but in a way, to have Rabbi Wein give a shiur, I feel like, you know, in a small way, like the Vilna Gaon, and then it's downhill from there. So I hope this will not be disappointing. Another just preliminary announcement, my friend Moshe Kaur just completed the publication of his work on the commentary of the Maharal on Rashi, the Gur Aryeh. And there is a book launch at the OU Center this Monday, May 18th, at 8:45. For some reason, I'm given top billing as a speaker. I mean, obviously, Dr. Kaur is the main event, but I'll be saying a few words as well. So again, if you're interested, 8:45, Monday, May 18th, and the work itself is very, very worthwhile for people. I apologize. 7:45, I'm sorry. I'm still not used to military time. Okay. 7:45, OU Center, May 18th, book launch for the Dr. Kaur's translation of the Gur Aryeh, which is the Maharal's commentary on Rashi's commentary on the Chumash. We're going to be giving shiurim on the book of the Kuzari. I understand Rabbi Wein gave you a lot of the history of Yehuda Halevi. I'm not going to repeat everything, but a few points I need to be sure that we're familiar with before we can proceed. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lived in the 11th century. He was a product of the Golden Age of Spain, a time when Jews were very prominent in economics and politics and philosophy, in science. They were very well respected in Muslim Spain. But at the same time, similar to the situation of Jews in comfortable Western countries, there was a certain amount of assimilation. People were sometimes ashamed of their Judaism. They thought the way to get ahead in life was to be like the Goyim, to assimilate and the like. And in many ways, we look at the Kuzari. The Kuzari is always classified as a book of Jewish philosophy. That is, you know, in any library, that's how it'll be classified. And although Rabbi Yehuda Halevi clearly had a mastery of philosophy, which at that time meant Aristotelian philosophy, that's the only thing that it meant, in many ways, as we will see, the Kuzari is profoundly anti-philosophy. It is actually a book against philosophy, not only against the conclusions of philosophy, which is obvious, he doesn't accept the conclusions of philosophy, but virtually against the whole philosophic enterprise. The profound insight of Yehuda Halevi is that the deepest truths of human existence are not obtained by philosophical speculation, but by experience, emotion, and intuition. In many, many ways, the Kuzari is a precursor to things like Kabbalah, to Hasidus, which is why, indeed, the Kuzari became very, very popular in Hasidic circles, and it's very popular in Dati Leumi circles for reasons that we will discuss. The Kuzari was written before the Rambam, so by the time the Rambam came on the scene, the Rambam was familiar with Rav Yehuda Halevi. And in fact, there are a few places where the Rambam, I don't want to say rips off, but more or less plagiarizes some ideas in the Kuzari. But I have to say that I think that the Rambam was kind of bewildered by a book like the Kuzari, because the Kuzari, although there are isolated ideas that the Rambam agreed with, but the orientation of the Kuzari was so opposed to Maimonides' categories of thought that I think he basically would just have been bewildered. He says, what on earth is this book trying to do? So one has to understand that the Kuzari and the Rambam, obviously in many, many areas they overlap. They believe in Hashem gave the Torah, they believe in the 613 mitzvot, they believe in Torah Shebal Peh. They had the same religion, there's no question. But their patterns of thought were very, very different. And Rav Yudah Halevi was a poet, indeed. We know that his main career was, he wrote poetry. Much of his poetry was religious poetry, but he also wrote secular poetry in his early years. Love songs, wine songs, we tend not to study those in yeshivas, and the like. And it is also true, as he got older, he moved away from that secular background, and he wrote the Kuzari towards the end of his life, and of course we know the end of his life, he tried to go to Eretz Yisrael, etc. But Rav Yudah Halevi approaches religious issues through the eyes of a poet more than the eyes of a philosopher. And we don't always realize that, because he does know philosophy, he does use philosophical terminology, but his orientation is much more emotional. It is based on feeling, it is based on experience, and the like. And as I say, I think a book like this would frankly confuse the Rambam. The Rambam just wouldn't take it in. Let me point out that if you wanted to create a linkage to the Rambam, we would actually go much earlier than Rav Yudah Halevi. The first book, what is the first book of Jewish philosophy? Now obviously Chazal, in the Medrash, in the Gemara, give us many philosophical insights through the medium of Agadata, but there is no systematic theology in the works of Chazal. In fact, Agadata is profoundly unsystematic. It goes from topic to topic. We have isolated, profound insights into human nature, into God, into Torah, but there's no kind of codification of the statements of the basic Jewish beliefs. So the first systematic work of Jewish theology is a work of Rav Sadia Gaon, who lived in Egypt and then Babylonia. He was the Gaon of Sura. And this was in the 900s. This was before Rav Yudah Halevi. And this is called the Sefer Emunot V'Deot, Beliefs and Appropriate Opinions. And this was a true Jewish theology that talks about the proofs of the existence of God and God's divine providence and revelation and Mashiach and a resurrection of the dead. And Rav Sadia Gaon was very much rooted in Aristotelian philosophy, as the Rambam was later. And Rav Sadia Gaon attempts to use rigorous philosophical logic to prove his propositions. There are, Emunot V'Deot is of course a sefer that's still around today, and you can study it, you can look at it. Those of you from Baltimore might remember Rabbi Samuel Rosenblatt. Rav Samuel Rosenblatt was the son of the famous Chazan Yossele Rosenblatt. But in addition, he was a quite eminent academic in his own right. He was the Rav of Beth Tefillah. And one of his accomplishments was he actually translated for the Yale Judaica series Rav Sadia Gaon's work, Emunot V'Deot. Now that's an old translation that goes back to the 1940s and the like, but there are, you know, more recent translations and also Hebrew commentaries and the like. So basically, to simplify, we have Emunot V'Deot, then around 150 years later we have the Kuzari, and then around 100 years after that, we have the Rambam's Mora Nevuchim. But the Kuzari is clearly the odd man out. The Rambam's Mora Nevuchim is very much connected in the intellectual tradition of Rav Sadia Gaon. The Kuzari is really a rejection of that tradition. So the Kuzari is an anti-philosophical book of Jewish philosophy. As a result, it has a very, very different orientation. And in many ways, when you try to read it as a book of rigid philosophy, you're going to be disappointed. Because the Kuzari, you know, makes certain proofs for different things, and you can ask yourself, well, that doesn't prove it. Well, in a way, that's not the point. He's there to tell you what Judaism is. He is a person that had tremendous pride in the Jewish people and in the Jewish religion and in what Judaism brings to the world. And part of his goal is to inspire that pride in an assimilated community that had lost that pride. And that is why many find the Kuzari very, very relevant even today, because in many parts of the world, that's exactly where the Jewish people are, a lack of pride, a lack of recognizing our significance. So you have to read the Kuzari as a poet and not as a philosopher. That would be one point that I'd like to make. Now, we know, by the way, you'll remember that Rav Yehuda Halevi is also the author, as they say, of the many poems, and one of his poems is a Shabbos Zemer, Yom Shabbaton Ein Lishkoach, Yona Masaba Manoach. That is Rav Yehuda Halevi. And in fact, his name, the first letter of every stanza, spells out Yehuda, and that is none other than the famous Rav Yehuda Halevi. I am absolutely certain Rabbi Wein mentioned this, but as you know, Rav Yehuda Halevi, towards the end of his life, gave up the affluence and wealth and prestige of Spain to come to Eretz Israel, where he would live in poverty and the like. But there's great, great uncertainty. Did he get here? The best historical evidence indicates that he died before he got to Eretz Israel, perhaps in Alexandria. There are some accounts that he actually did arrive in Eretz Israel. And then, of course, there's the famous legend, but I think, unfortunately, it might be a legend, that he was at the actual gates of Yerushalayim. He was reciting his Tisha B'Av Kina, Tzion halo tishali lishlom asiroyach. Zion, do you not ask and yearn for the peace of your Jews that are imprisoned in the Galut? And the legend has it that he was trampled and stabbed by an Arab horseman on the very gates of Yerushalayim. Again, it's a beautiful, moving story about the yearning of this precious soul. And like Moshe Rabbeinu, he was almost there but couldn't get in. And yet, as I say, historically, like the golem of the Maharal, you know, we really can't say that that happens. But the one thing is very, very clear, that he did leave Spain to come to Eretz Israel at great, great personal sacrifice. And indeed, you can actually see his Aliyah cogitations in the Kuzari itself. Because in the Kuzari, there's a very famous passage where the king asks the rabbi, the anonymous rabbi, hey, if you Jews care so much about Israel, why don't you go there? Of course, keep in mind, every single question the king asks is Rav Yehuda Halevi making up the question. He's making up the questions and the answer. And the rabbi answers, this is our shame and this is our humiliation, that Hashem gives us the opportunity and we do not take advantage of it. Rav Yehuda Halevi is talking to himself as well as to us. And at the end of the Kuzari, the rabbi says, gotta leave now, I'm going to Eretz Yisrael. And that mirrors, that echoes with Rav Yehuda Halevi's decision shortly after the Kuzari, that he did exactly the same thing. Again, it's such an amazing thing. You know, if you think about what it meant, because of course Aliyah is more of a modern word, but what it meant to go to Eretz Yisrael in the 11th century, what life was like then, the hardships, the desolation. When the Ramban went to Eretz Israel, again around 150 years later, he talked about the fact that the more holy the place, the more desolate it was. There was not even a million of Jews in Yerushalayim. The main communities were in Akko, they were further north. You know, today, of course, Baruch Hashem, I'm speaking to the choir because we all live here, but today, to come to Eretz Israel, all right, you know, there's a very inconvenient flight. You know, it is crowded, I admit, just having taken the flight. Not so comfortable. But, you know, you can get Ben and Jerry's, and you can get even Skippy peanut butter, all the things. Okay, 30 years ago, we had these hardships. You couldn't get good peanut butter. You couldn't get good toilet paper. It took a long time to get a phone. All right, so you had an excuse then. Right. But today, Baruch Hashem, you know, all the conveniences. And yet, because it's not as comfortable as America, you know, too hard. Well, think about Rav Yehuda Halevi. Think about what it meant then. And think about the fact that even then he wrote, How could we turn down the gift that Hashem gives us? That's what he said then. Of course, I remember, even from a secular standpoint, I remember reading Golda Meir's autobiography. And she talks about, you know, she went from the Ukraine to Milwaukee. She went to a public school in Milwaukee, and then as a young married woman, she came to Eretz Israel. And, you know, she talked about draining the swamps and sleeping in the mud. I mean, it's an amazing thing, these founding fathers and mothers. Religiously, we have a lot of disagreements, but their mesiras nefesh to build up the land was really very, very unbelievable. So even, you know, within the past 100 years, the sacrifices that people make. So this is the Kuzri. The Kuzri, again, the Yehuda HaLevi basically is talking to us, but is also talking to him, talking to himself. Now, basically, the Kuzri is a historical novel. That's what it is, a historical novel with a lot of didactic, you know, content. And the historical novel is based on a true incident. And, you know, I'm sure we want to talk about that. That's the conversion of the Khazars in the 10th century. This was a Russian warlike kingdom that mysteriously converted to Judaism. Now, why they did convert to Judaism, and were they religious Jews, and was it a halakhically valid conversion? These are very, very far from certain. Some have argued they converted to Judaism not out of some spiritual epiphany, but simply because they wanted to preserve their ethnic identity, because they were surrounded by Christians and Muslims on all sides. So they figured, we got to be different. And the only difference they were aware of is, let's be Jewish. You know. So we don't have to discuss the actual halachic status of the Khazars. I mean, who was the Beis Din that converted them? We don't have to discuss whether they kept mitzvos. We don't even have to discuss the halachic validity of a conversion that was forced upon you by the king, that basically said, everybody has to convert or I'll kill you. I mean, that, right? Although I do want to point out, there was an old anthropological theory, which you could study, that actually posits that the majority of Ashkenazic Jews are descended from the Khazars. It was such a theory, in which case the Jewish status of the Khazars would be extremely important, because it would determine if we're Jewish.
But I thought it was disputed.
It was disputed and largely discredited. It's largely discredited, but there was such an idea. So the actual status of the Khazars, which in any way became assimilated and more or less either extinct or totally assimilated in other groups, is not really important for us, but the story of the Khazars was a source of great fascination to the Jews of the Middle Ages. First of all, it was a source of pride to think that here you have a nation which was not Jewish, that saw so much goodness in Judaism that they wanted to become Jewish. That says something good about us. It was a source of pride, and Rav Yehuda HaLevi wanted to seize on that story as kind of the basis for building up Jewish pride, as I say, was his prime goal. Now, a lot of the details he either made up or the details were made up. I mean, they were not necessarily historical. But the story that he wove was that this king was a righteous king, and this king kept on having dreams from angels. And the dreams, the angels kept on telling him again and again, your kavanot, your intentions, your motives in life are good and elevated, but your deeds are defective. You have the right desires, but you don't have the right ma'asim. But it didn't tell him what he has to do. It just said, you're not going in the right path. So the king is described as a seeker of wisdom. The king is described as someone who looks for truth. And as a result, the beginning of the Kuzri is similar to almost those classic jokes about the rabbi, the priest, and he assembles a group of three people, which he then augments with a fourth. His initial three are the philosopher, that's the Aristotelian philosopher, the Christian, the priest, which at that time was only Catholicism, And that is called Edom, consistent with rabbinic terminology, that the Roman Empire, the Catholic Church, is identified with Esav, Edom, so therefore we still call that Edom. And then the Muslim, who is called the Yishmael, because we believe the Arab nations come from Yishmael. And in the Kuzari, the king asks a number of questions as a seeker of truth. And in the first part of the Kuzari, there's a brief, relatively brief discussion with the philosopher, and then a brief discussion with the Christian, and then a brief discussion with the Muslim. And the king is not satisfied. I'll go over this in a bit more detail. So he finally says in desperation, I didn't want to bother with the Jew, because Jews are so despised and so numerically insignificant that the truth can certainly not be with them. But I guess I don't have a choice. So he finally gets the Jew. The Jew is referred to as the Chaver. Chaver means the scholar. And most of the book is a dialogue, discussions, questions and answers, arguments between the Chaver and the Khuzar, which is the king of the Khazars, the Melech, and the like. And that is the bulk of the book. At the end of the book, the two things happen. The Melech wants to become Jewish, which is how the nation became Jewish. That's the story. And the Chaver wants to go to Eretz Israel. And that's kind of the parting of the ways at the end of the book. Now, in the best tradition of historical novels, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi seems to create the pretense that he found the long-lost manuscript and he is simply reproducing a manuscript or a transcript of discussions. In fact, if you look at some of the cover pages of the Kuzari, it even says, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi didn't write the Kuzari, this is the Rabbi Yitzchak HaSangari. Rabbi Yitzchak HaSangari means Rabbi Yitzchak the Defender. But again, that's all made up, meaning basically, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi basically says, I am publishing a long-lost manuscript of this rabbi, Rav Yitzchak HaSangari, who convinced the king of the Khazars to convert 150 years before. In reality, we all know, Rav Yehuda HaLevi wrote the questions, Rav Yehuda HaLevi wrote the answers, and as a result, even the questions are very important, because the questions, for example, the Eretz Yisrael question, why aren't you Jews in Eretz Yisrael, is not just this non-Jewish king attacking the Jews, it's Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi giving mussar to the Jewish people. Why aren't you in Eretz Yisrael? So, by and large, although the foundation of the Kuzari is the historical story of the Khazars' conversion to Judaism, which indeed did occur, although as I say, we do not know if it was religiously motivated or not, but he just took the bare bones of that story. And he constructed an entire edifice of questions and answers. And as I say, his primary goal was to address an assimilated society that did not see Judaism as meaningful in life. And he wanted to instill a pride in the greatness of Am Yisrael and in their relationship to HaKadosh Baruch. Okay, so that's kind of the framework. Now, the framework of the Kuzari is Mamarim, meaning there are chapters that are called Mamarim, and there are 5 Mamarim. The organization is, once again, I think we would have to say it's more poetic organization than rigid philosophical organization. He comes back to different themes. It jumps from topic to topic to topic, and then things that he talks about in one mamar, he goes back to another mamarim, and because of the question and answer format, sometimes the king himself will switch topics and go into other things. So the organizational structure is difficult, and indeed, whole books have been written to try to discern the organizational structure of the Kuzari. It's not at all a simple matter. And because of this, by the way, the great late Rosh Yeshiva of Hebron, Rav Yecheskel Sarna, you may have heard of him, he was Nifter in the 1960s, he actually reorganized the Kuzari based on topics. That's very interesting. In other words, he took the Kuzari and he divided it into topics. Hashem, Am Yisrael, Torah, Eretz Yisrael, and he collated all the different teachings of the Kozari scattered through the five Mamarim in terms of like a topical index. That's very, very useful because that brings together what Rav Yehuda Levi says on a given topic from all parts of the book, but it does take away the dialogue, it does take away the conversational aspect that many people find engaging. But it would be useful as a companion work, so if you're interested in actually reading the book, so get a Kuzari, with or without a translation, as you need, and then if you get Rav Sarna's book, you can actually see quickly everything Rav Yehuda Levi says about Eretz Yisrael, in the Kuzari, just following it by an alphabetical, topical arrangement. Okay? Alrighty. So now, let me just mention some of the foundations of Rav Yehuda Halevi's philosophy. The first foundation is that religious truths are established primarily by experience and not by reason. And by that I mean the following. When we say, how do we know there is God? How do we know there is Torah? Or Torah is true? Instead of some logical deductive process, Rav Yehuda Halevi says, we know things are true because of the historical experiences that we have undergone. That God took us out of Egypt, that God gave us the man, that God gave us the Torah. Now, the first problem you're going to have with that is to argue from history is ultimately a circular proposition because one might deny the historicity of the very occurrence. To say, I have to worship God because God took me out of Egypt. Well, how do I know God took me out of Egypt? The Torah says so? Well, how do I know the Torah is true? Maybe somebody wrote the Torah, meaning to argue from history presupposes the accuracy of history, and that could be a real issue. Now let me explain, I'm going to give you two answers for that. Answer number one is that based on the milieu that Rav Yehuda Halevi faced, that actually was not a compelling question. Because keep in mind that both Christianity and Islam accepted the historical accuracy of the Exodus of Egypt and Matan Torah. Right? Christianity believed that those events happened. They simply claimed that God replaced the choice of Israel with those who believed in Jesus because the Jews rejected Jesus. And Islam is the same thing. Islam has another supersession. So in many ways, the modern atheistic problem of who says it happened was not a problem he even had to address that much. Because in his milieu, those events were accepted as realities. Which is why, as I say, the Kuzari may not address necessarily the modern atheist. In point of fact, the atheist is not even one of his four people, right? Who, his philosopher who still believes in some notion of God. The Christian, the Muslim, the Jew. What about the atheist? There are no atheists, right? So basically, Rav Yehuda Halevi is talking to a community that believes in God. So as a result, therefore, based on the audience he is addressing, the historicity of biblical events was not that much of an issue. That's one thing. But the second point, which is the point he actually makes, is that Rav Yehuda Halevi, and this is, in fact, this is such a famous part of the Kuzari, that this is called the Kuzari principle. And if you look at the webs, people attack the Kuzari principle all the time, people don't like it. I'm going to tell you what it is. I'm not going to engage in an extensive defense because my point is, it is my idiosyncratic belief that the Kuzari does not have to be read as a philosophically rigorous treatise. And that is not how it should be read. But the Kuzari principle is based on the theory of audacity and the big lie. And that is based on the following idea. Judaism is the only religion that claims open, miraculous interventions that happened to millions of people. Let's take Christianity for an example. Christianity does believe, or does teach, that there were a number of miracles that occurred either by Jesus or through Jesus. They have the virgin birth, which is, of course, a miracle that can absolutely have no empirical evidence of. A woman gives birth, you know. What are you going to say? You know, but that's a miracle they claim. Jesus' resurrection, you know, who can prove that? Even the notion that he, walked on water. These are miracles that occurred in front of a relatively, or allegedly occurred, in front of a relatively small number of people. Now, if I come to you and you trust me, or anyone that you trust, and I tell you, God spoke to me. I had a revelation. I had a vision. You might trust me. You didn't have the vision, but you trust me. And as a result, you'll believe me. And I might get over time more and more believers who believe that I'm a man of prophecy, a man of vision, a man of miracles. And if you ask the question, well, how come you never see me doing any miracles? I say, I only do it in the privacy of my home. So as a result, the claims that other religions make of private miracles, now maybe they're true. We're not saying they're false. But there is no credibility and believability in the particular story. Because this is a falsifiable document. Now again, this is not proof of falsity. This is simply absence of proof of truth. Now, if I were to say that God did a miracle to me, I could fool you. But if I were to say, God did a miracle to you, don't you see God speaking to you? You're going to say, no, I don't. And I'm not going to be able to convince you. I can convince you of what I saw, but I'm not going to be able to convince you of what you saw. And even if there might be occasionally gullible or suggestible people, but certainly millions and millions of people aren't going to believe something that didn't happen. So the Kuzari's theory is, Matan Torah was an event that we claim, we believe, we say. Now let's say it didn't happen, but we say that 3 million people heard God proclaim, I am the Lord your God that took you out of Mitzrayim. Right? 3 million people were taken out of Mitzrayim with 10 makos. Now the question is, let's assume that didn't happen. How does such a story start? In other words, let's start off being a skeptic. It didn't happen. But even if you believe it didn't happen, you also have to believe that people believed it happened. You can't deny that. You cannot deny that the Jewish people believed it happened. How does such a belief start, since it would require that millions of people have a belief? Right, so the Kuzari says, the fact that Judaism involves miracles that were done on a mass scale, these are non-falsifiable events. And if they're non-falsifiable events, that is proof that they happened. So he grounds the truth of Judaism not in logical argumentation, but in the inability to falsify pivotal, actual, historical experiences. This is called the Kuzari principle, that you can't falsify mass revelation because you can't convince people that they experienced something that they in fact did not experience. Again, if you're a blogger or you like to read blogs, you can read discussions on whether this is an ironclad principle. I'm not here to argue the principle so much. I just want to point out that there are two different ideas of why Rav Yehuda Halevi considers history to be so important. In other words, why is history so essential as part of faith? Reason number one is because he was already addressing an audience that conceded the truth of those experiences. So the issue is, in other words, nobody was asking, how do I know there was an Exodus? Christians said there was, and Muslims said there was. So in a sense, he didn't have to prove anything on that point. But the second point is, he says, these are non-falsifiable events because they involve large numbers of people who could not otherwise be convinced, as opposed to other religious traditions that start off with miracles that allegedly happened to small numbers of people, in which case you can convince people that these miracles happened. Okay, this is called the Kuzari principle. And once again, the Kuzari's point is that religion is grounded in shared historical experience. It is not grounded in philosophical argumentation. In fact, the Kuzari explains, this is why in the Ten Commandments it says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem, Asher Hotseisicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, who took you out of the land of Egypt. It's interesting, the famous commentator, the Ibn Ezra, Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, who was a friend of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, some say he was a son-in-law, some say he was a mechutin, whatever the relationship was. In fact, there's a whole story, I don't know if Rabbi Wein said this story, there's a story there, the Ibn Ezra was a traveler. He used to go, he went to many countries, India, he was a traveler all over the place. And he showed up in Spain, and he looked like a vagabond. And Rav Yehuda HaLevi, again, these are legends. Rav Yehuda HaLevi had a daughter who was getting older. She was not married. And his wife told him, get her married, get her a husband. So legend has it, he was so frustrated, he made a vow, okay, the first guy that walks through my house is going to marry my daughter. It's like Yitzchak. So the Ibn Ezra, who looks like a tramp, walks through the house. So Rav Yehuda HaLevi is, oh yeah, yeah, I better get Hataras Nedarim. I don't want my daughter to marry him. And he didn't realize this was a big Talmud Chacham. So the story goes, Rav Yehuda HaLevi was working on a Zemer. It wasn't Yom Shabbaton, but another Shabbos Zemer. And it was an alphabetical acrostic. And when he had reached the letter Resh, he had a writer's block. So he walked outside to clear his head, and the Ibn Ezra came in. The Ibn Ezra himself was a great poet. Kieshmera Shabbat is from the Ibn Ezra, that Zemer. So he finished the Zemer with beautiful poetic phraseology. And when Rav Yehuda HaLevi saw that the Ibn Ezra was a talented poet and a Talmud Chacham, he had his daughter marry him. Again, these are legends. I don't know if they're true at all. But in the commentary of the Ibn Ezra, he actually says, my friend, he doesn't say my father-in-law, my friend Rav Yehuda HaLevi asked me a question. Why does it say, I am the God who took you out of Egypt? It should have said, I am the God who created heaven and earth, because that's a more powerful idea. Right? Now the Ibn Ezra's own answer, which he gives, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to give a unique claim to the Jewish people, meaning to say, Hashem is saying, why do we as Jews have special obligations? Briat HaOlam would obligate everybody. Yetziat Mitzrayim obligates us as Jews, right? That's the Ibn Ezra's answer. But what's interesting is, the Ibn Ezra makes it sound like Rav Yehuda HaLevi asks him a question. I mean, the truth is, in the Kuzari, Rav Yehuda HaLevi himself raises the question and gives his own answer. And Rav Yehuda HaLevi's answer is that Briat HaOlam, none of us were there. We did not experience creation. Yetziat Mitzrayim was something we experienced as a Jewish people, and experience is more important than even either philosophy or just being told that God created. If somebody said God created the world, I would say, how do I know God created the world? But Yetziat Mitzrayim was in the collective memory of millions of Jews, and was handed down. And that is why, once again, history is more important than, I'm sorry, yeah, experience and history is more important than reason. That is principle number one of his philosophy. Principle number two And in a way, this is all connected. These things overlap like links in a chain. And that is, the basis of obedience to God is gratitude for the historical encounters that we have with the Almighty. It is because God took us out of Egypt. It is because God sustained us. It is because he gave us the man. It is because he allowed us to defeat the seven hostile nations that lived in Eretz Yisrael. It is because he gave us the gift of Eretz Yisrael. All of this creates a debt. The debt is based on gratitude. That is why the Torah was given to Am Yisrael, simply because God didn't do the same things to the other nations that he did for Am Yisrael, and therefore they have less of a debt. That is why the Torah is given to Am Yisrael. And indeed, I want to point out that in later Sifrei Chassidut, the idea of gratitude is so important. Let's take the word Yehudi. Every Jew is called Yehudi. Now, technically, Yehudi is referring to the tribe of Judah. Why is every Jew called Yehudi? So the simple interpretation was that after the exile of the 10 tribes, so the only remaining kingdom of the Jews was Malchut Yehuda, and when that was exiled, so it was Yehuda. In fact, in Roman times, before this land was called Palestine, it was called Judea, the land of Yehuda. But the Sfas Emes says homiletically a beautiful thought. Why did Leah call her fourth son Yehuda? So the Torah says, because she said, Hapam Oda Es Hashem. I am grateful to God. Hoda'ah. That's what the Chumash says. Rashi says, why was she grateful with child number 4? Because she knew with Ruach HaKodesh there would be 12 tribes. And she knows there are 4 mothers. Sarah, Rivka, the 4 mothers, Yaakov's 4 wives, are Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, and Zilpah. So she figures 12 divided by 4, each of Yaakov's wives is entitled to 3 sons. So, the first 3 sons, she's not grateful. It's Kotmir, it's coming to me. When she has number 4, Natalti Yeser Al Chelki, I've gotten more than I deserve. What is gratitude? The feeling Hashem has given me more than I deserve. Says the Sfas Emes, every Jew is called a Yehudi because we have to go through life with the feeling Hashem has given me more than I deserve. A beautiful idea. The very meaning of Jew, you know, you could look up Random House Dictionary, and it might say, Jew is slang for being cheap. Well, I think they took that out, but that actually appeared in some dictionaries as a slang term. You know, unfortunately, to Jew somebody meant to cheat somebody. But the real meaning of Jew, Yehudi, a grateful nation. Hakarat HaTov is the very identity of our nation, to be grateful. And it's an amazing thing. We have been through many, many tough times. Pogroms, Holocaust, the Golos, the Chorban, going all the way back for thousands of years. And still today, so many difficulties. And yet, the very definition of a Jew, Nataldi, Yeser Al-Shonki. Well, the Kuzari is not the inventor of this idea, but it is very notable that he grounds obedience to God on gratitude for the historical encounters that God has with the Jewish people. And therefore, in the Kuzari, this idea of gratitude is extremely important, and it's even the explanation of why the Torah was not given to the Gentiles, simply because the Gentiles did not receive that measure of good. Now, of course, that doesn't answer the question, so why didn't God do good stuff for them? That's another question. But given the realities that Yetzias Mitzrayim and Man and miracles and Nisim and prophecies were all given to us, that creates a certain debt. Indebtedness arises from proximity to God and the love that God shows us. Okay. So that's a second point, right? So the first point is the truth of religion is grounded in experience, not reason. The second point is gratitude as a foundational element of obedience. A third principle can be summarized by the English expression, deed, not creed. Now again, I think this is an argument that the Rambam would take very sharp issue with. You know, it's interesting, we know that the Rambam formulated 13 basic principles that a Jew must believe. Yud Gimel Ikrei Emunah. Where are these principles articulated? They're not in the Mishneh Torah per se, but in the Hakdamah, in the introduction of the commentary of the Rambam to the 11th parak of Sanhedrin, which talks about which Jews go to the Olam Haba and which do not. The Rambam articulates 13 principles, which if you do not believe these principles, you are a heretic, you are an apikoris, and you are not entitled to a share in the world to come. And the Ani Ma'amin, which appears in the Siddur, I just want to point out, those are not the Rambam's actual words. That was a later anonymous popularization of the principles of the Ani Ma'amin. Similarly, the poem Yigdal, which many people say in Shul Friday night, some people say it even every day, if you go over it, it actually is the 13 principles of faith, again, in a popular form. By the way, Rav Soloveitchik was against Yigdal in Shul because he basically said that it's a catechism, meaning to say Jewish prayer is about prayer. It's not about affirming theology. In other words, he says the notion that you recite principles of faith in a prayer service is much more of a Christian idea than a Jewish idea. So he was against reciting Yigdal. Although I have to say, I'm not sure if that's totally correct. Because if you think about the Shema is not a prayer. In other words, we have davening. Shemona Esrei is I pray to God. But we have Shema, and Shema is essentially a statement of principles of faith. So the notion is, what do we believe? Maybe not. Well, I mean, Shema itself is a statement of belief. On the other hand, V'ahavta are commandments. So maybe it's a little different. It's not just to say, I believe this, I believe this, I believe this. So Rav Soloveitchik was against it. But be it as it may, the Rambam does have 13 principles of faith. And we say even today, you constantly hear, that if you don't believe in the 13 principles of faith, you might be biologically a Jew, but you are not religiously a Jew. You are not a member of the Jewish religion. So the Rambam felt very strongly that Judaism was not only about mitzvot and deeds and actions, but Judaism was about fundamental beliefs and orientations. And if you didn't have those beliefs, you were not properly Jewish. Now, I want to point out that although people assume that the Rambam was accepted by everybody on this point, it's not at all the case. Around 150 years after the Rambam, there was another great Jewish philosopher, Rav Yosef Albo. And Rav Yosef Albo wrote a book called Sefer HaIkarim, which is another great book in Jewish philosophy. And Sefer HaIkarim basically said, he disagreed with the Rambam, he said that instead of there being 13 principles you have to believe in, there's only 3 principles. And those 3 principles are called Ikarim, fundamentals or roots. And then there are derivative principles that are called Anafim, branches. And if you don't believe in the branches, you still have a tree. And his 3 principles are Metzias Hashem, there is a God, who created heaven and earth. Principle number two, reward and punishment. God rewards goodness, and God punishes evil. And it could be this world, next world, whatever it is, but there's reward and punishment. And principle number three is revelation of his will through Matan Torah, meaning God did not leave the definition of good and evil to the New York Times or the Jerusalem Post, but there was a revelation as to what is good and evil. Now, to highlight for a moment, and as I'm going to move away from Avida Levi for a moment, because we'll come back to him, let's take something like this. Let's take the belief in Mashiach, or the belief in resurrection of the dead. According to the Rambam, if I don't believe that there will be a human Mashiach, let's say I believe, well, there will be a messianic age, but there's not going to be a person that is Mashiach ben David. Or let's say I believe in the soul, in Olam Haba, but I don't believe there'll be physical resurrection. According to the Rambam, I am an apikoros. I am a heretic. I do not have a share in the world to come because I am denying the 12th or the 13th principle of the Ani Ma'amin. According to Rabbi Yosef Alvo, this is how he would classify it. He would say, belief in Mashiach or belief in Olam Haba, in Tchiyat HaMeisim, is not ikar, it is anaf. The ikar is that there's some system of reward and punishment. Now the particular way that reward and punishment will be manifest, whether it's Olam Haba, whether it's Mashiach, whether it's Tchiyat HaMeisim, that, he says, is a matter of branches. It is not a matter of fundamental. Now, I want to be clear you understand this. I don't mean to say, and Rav Yosef Alvo didn't mean to say, he denied Mashiach. He certainly believed in Mashiach, and he certainly believed in the resurrection of the dead. But he said, if you didn't believe, you would be foolish, you would be mistaken, but you would not be heretical. It's important to know, there's a distinction between mistaken beliefs and heretical beliefs. By the way, this distinction is totally obscured today, where every deviation from standard theology, you're called an apikoros. And that's very, very unfortunate. For example, if somebody believes the Lubavitcher Rebbe is Mashiach, or someone believes Mashiach will come back from the dead, even if that is mistaken, it is absolutely not heretical. So people have liberty within Torah to have many mistaken ideas. And I'm not even making, I don't even mean to say that that's a mistake. I'm not taking the position of that. But what I'm saying is that the worst it is a mistake to use heresy, on something like that. Even like the Rambam wouldn't be appropriate because you're believing in Mashiach. But Rabbi Yosef Alvo takes the very revolutionary position that even if a person were to deny Mashiach Legabri, that would be a mistaken belief, but not heretical, as long as you believe there is Sechar V'Onesh. So, even something more radical. Let's say that God, one would believe that God could assume physical form. According to the Rambam, that is heresy, that is apikorsis. One will forfeit their share in the world to come, because it is a fundamental principle of Judaism that God has no physicality, God has no corporal essence. That is kind of our mainstream thought. I just want to point out that according to Rav Yosef Alvo, as long as you believe in the Supreme Creator, ascribing some aspect of physicality is a mistake. Of course it's a mistake, but it is not a fundamental mistake. So the point I want to make is that the Rambam's 13 Nikrei Emunah were not universally accepted as absolutely binding. Rav Yosef Alvo was mechalek between anafim and ikarim. Now, is there a psak halacha on this? This raises a fascinating question. Is there such a thing as definitive halachic resolution of theological disputes? Some have argued Halakha can only pertain to what you do. It cannot pertain to what you think. And if there are religious sources that support different ideas within the framework of Torah, you can continue to think those thoughts. On the other hand, other great rabbis, again, I'm not going to be machria on this, other great rabbis have said that the same way there are definitive halachic rules for actions, there are definitive halachic rules on theology. And that's why you get the odd idea. For example, someone would say, well, Rav Yosef Albo could say what he said because there was not yet a definitive halacha. So when he said it, he wasn't an apikoros. If I were to say the same thing, I am now an apikoros because the halacha has so decided. It's a peculiar idea, but there's an idea that, okay, he wasn't an apikoros because that was prior to the halachic resolution of the appropriate theology. Again, it's a controversial issue, and I'll give you an example of where this comes up. Many of you may have heard of, and I'll mention names because it's a public matter, Rabbi Natan Slifkin. Right? So this was a kind of a cause celeb, a young man, a very, very talented person, who writes books about the conflicts of Torah and science and the idea that particularly there are statements in Chazal that contradict science as we understand it. So there are different approaches, but the approach he likes to take is that when Chazal were talking as scientists, they only knew the science of the time, and as a result, the infallibility of Chazal might pertain only to halachic matters. It does not pertain to scientific matters. Which, of course, actually creates a lot of complications when there are halachas that are derived based on scientific assumptions. Okay. So, he has a lot of sources. He quotes Rav Avraham ben Arambam, he quotes the Gaon, and he has a lot of sources that say that. But, he got in tremendous trouble, right? He's excommunicated left and right, and book burning, and all sorts of things. So as a result, he kind of had to leave the Haredi world, and he got embraced by the modern Orthodox world, so he used to be Nosson, now he's Natan, okay. Whatever it is. But, when people said, how can you say these things? Apikorsis, apikorsis, apikorsis. He said, what do you mean apikorsis? I'm quoting Rav Hai Gaon. I'm quoting Rav Avraham ben Arambam. So the response that he got was, they had a right to say it because there had not yet been a consensus. But once the consensus has been against those positions, you're now an apikorsis. So many people find that very, very difficult. How can you say that an idea that was considered to be a non-apikoros idea is now apikorsis? Okay, I'm not going to answer these questions because I don't want to get in trouble myself. I don't want to walk by and... So everything stays in this room, right? Okay.
Turn it off.
We'll have to go over that. Okay, but the point I want to make is that the notion of Ikrei Emuna highlights the Rambam's idea. And this is consistent with Rav Sadia Gaon, that Judaism is a comprehensive theological and philosophical system in which it's not enough to be a righteous person, and it's not enough to do good deeds, and it's not enough to serve Hashem, but you have to have definite and definitive beliefs. So I want to point out that this was the tradition of Rav Sadia Gaon, and this was absolutely the position of the Rambam. And this was, even Rav Yosef Albo, although he differed with the 13 principles, but he had these fundamental ideas. Rav Yehuda Halevi is much more fluid. He says, the way we serve God is not so much by what we believe, but by how we behave. We keep God's commandments. Now, of course, obviously, I don't want to overstate this, because obviously this presupposes a belief system that you believe God said it. I mean, you can't say belief is not relevant. But the belief is relatively simple. God gave the Torah. And once God gave the Torah, my duty is to keep those commandments, live a virtuous life. And the details of the theology are simply not as important. This is the notion of deed versus creed. And again, it's consistent with the de-emphasis on organized philosophy. So again, although the Khuzri is certainly a philosophical work, but a lot of it is designed to kind of denigrate the importance of theology and philosophy. Okay? So that's some basic ideas in his philosophy. We will again continue with this. Yeah.
You said the second state of his is gratitude.
Yes.
Well, many terrible things happened after his time. The expulsion from Spain.